I really think that the purpose is to really make space for the unknown, uncertainty, and for our kind of humility in the face of the complexity of our belonging to the physical world. So it's our animality, our physicality, all of that is so complicated and difficult to grapple with. And the unknown is and uncontrollable is a huge abyss, as we know, for everybody. So I do think that I'm trying to pivot here a little bit towards meeting the patient's attempts to grapple with that unknown.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast consists of conversations with psychoanalysts from around the world who share with us their clinical and psychoanalytic work with individuals both on and off the couch. And what we mean by off the couch is that they share with us their community involvement in many different venues apart from their consultation rooms. They describe their work in hospitals, in community clinics, in refugee centers, in classrooms, indeed in war zones. We also have conversations with psychoanalysts who are focusing their work on the couch, and they are continuing to refine both our familiar and novel understandings of the dynamic mind as it presents itself in the analytic situation. Please visit our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can subscribe, where you can see the recommended readings provided by our guests, and you can also leave a comment. I hope you enjoy these conversations and find them thoughtful and meaningful. And I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Sharon Bergner. Dr. Bergner is a clinical psychologist and psychoanalyst in full-time private practice in New York City. She is a member and former faculty member at the Institute for Psychoanalytic Training and Research and is currently an adjunct assistant clinical professor and clinical supervisor at the NYU postdoctoral program in psychotherapy and psychoanalysis, where she teaches a course on the body in analytic reverie. And indeed, it is the body that is the focus of our conversation today. It revolves around two papers she has written in the past. The first is called The Analytic Environment in Times of Bodily Dysfunction, and the second follow-up is called Seductive Symbolism. And the subject of these two papers is what happens inside a patient when they become physically ill? How does their mind engage with that? And likewise, how does the analytic practitioner engage with that? And she cautions us about shrinking our analytic space around the assumption that we know the cause of these medical problems. And she gives a number of clinical examples about this. We also take up the whole question of what does psychoanalysis have to offer about understanding etiologies of medical illnesses, while at the same time recognizing that we have much to offer about helping people deal with fragility, vulnerability, and uncertainty. I learned a great deal in reading and studying these papers, and Sharon is a serious thinker and a clinician in this area, and I hope you enjoy it as I did. Here's my conversation with Dr. Sharon Bergner. Sharon, welcome to the podcast. It's good to have you. When we become ill, or our bodies otherwise don't function as we want them to, we often get frightened, and it's a particular kind of fear. Anyone who's been through it, I think, knows what I'm describing. And that fear has a tendency to lead to a regression in how we experience ourselves, our pasts, our future, and the world around us. And that regression entails a return to childhood ways of understanding things, or imagining things, better said, that childhood notions of causality take front and center. They're always present in us adults, but they do become pressing at times. And the causality has to do with being good or bad, as children tend to think, and the badness is the usual suspects of hurtful feelings or transgressive feelings of various sorts. But as you point out in the papers we're to discuss today, it is not just individuals who have somatic difficulties that regress. You point out that our field has had a tendency to regress. And what I mean by that, or what you mean by that actually in your writings, is that the effort we have taken to create an analytic space for ourselves and our patients, an analytic space that is defined and created with a sense of uncertainty and ambiguity and openness and curiosity, that sort of regresses too into a collapsed notion of presumed causality and linearity. And some of the well-known examples, hopefully more from our past than our present, for example, the notion of infertility. A woman is understood a priori to have conflicts with her maternal identification and a sense of femininity. Or patients who suffer from asthma or olfocolitis are presumed to have conflicts over aggression, and cancer has been associated with loss. And the problem you point out, and in a sense provide a remedy for us, is that when the analyst and the patient are stuck in those regressed ways of thinking, the work can't take place. And at times, as you will point out in your writings, it hasn't taken place. I want to start us off by reading brief quotes from each of the two papers. Then I'm going to turn it over to you to elaborate for us. You write, "Beliefs about what caused their cancer are a central facet of patients' experience of illness. These beliefs make up the patient's theory of etiology, which derives from various sources, including conscious and unconscious fantasy. This paper highlights this dimension of patient's experience and the possible interaction between patient's psychogenic theories of etiology and their therapist's potentially generated psychogenic theories regarding patient's disease. It is suggested that a countertransferential pull for therapists exists to generate psychogenic theory regarding patient's cancer in the face of the threat of the impotency it presents." You also write, "Because patients in bodily related crises grapple actively with the question of causality and search for answers to the question, why do I have this, and its corollary, and so how can I fix it? The analyst's belief that she herself already knows why weaves into her inquiries and interpretations in a manner that centrally and directly affects the atmosphere of meaning-making in the room." Sharon, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Harvey. And first, thank you so much for the invitation to speak. So it's interesting to hear you describe it as a regression, which is not a word I used or thought of, but of course is central to the whole thing. But I would say that it's always there. In other words, so we have theories as psychoanalysts, and our theories, our understanding in all contexts, not just somatic contexts, is about understanding why someone is the way that they are. Why is it? And we go back to early psychic reality and psychic experience in order to understand how that got inscribed and is shaping the present. And so what I talk about in these papers is that we treat things that happen in the body the same way. We treat bodily symptoms as other symptoms, and we look to decode them in the same way that we decode other symptoms with our psychoanalytic tools, meaning go back and figure out what the root of this is, where it came from, what's the compromise, what's the deficit, what's the conflict, what went wrong that things got set up this way. And if we understand what went wrong such that things got set up this way, then via our understanding, we can help to shift and move towards something different and new, and there would be more choice, more freedom. That's just what our work is all about. And So what I talk about in these papers is that we bring that mindset to our work with patients when something is going wrong, as you described, with their bodies. And the something that goes wrong can be cancer, it can be infertility, it can be so many other things, colitis, Crohn's disease, but also more minor things. And what I talk about in this paper is a kind of collusion or collapse of space that I think characterizes the atmosphere in the work we do. If we show up to meet the patient's attempt to figure out and grapple and explore and contend with what's happening with my body, if we show up to meet the patient's process with our own sense that we already know and that we know how it works and that we are looking for the root cause back in the psychic past and in psychic reality. And I think, you know, I would say that patients, the search for why do I have this, what's happening with my body, it is really also about, in addition to the regression that you talk about, it's also about just the fact that the bodily self and it is complicated and it's built up of a whole history of all kinds of intersubjective early life experiences that get internalized. We can get into that later. So the relationship between the person and their body is always a thing. And when the body disturbs the self, then the person seeks to make sense of it. So it's kind of a crisis, and the person seeks to make sense of it, and then all kinds of fantasies, all kinds of stuff about me and what I'm about and what I'm like comes up. And so the papers are about really how do we meet the patient in that moment.
You write about what you just described. You write and you say, I wish to suggest that the conceptualization of linearity of psychogenesis, with which we are comfortably familiar, makes it seem as if we know more than we presently do. We do not know enough yet to characterize many interactions of the psyche-soma. And yet in our clinical thinking, shaped by the psychoanalytic theoretical context, we often believe that as clinicians, we either know or could discover through the psychoanalytic process, because we are rooted in psychoanalytic ideas about psychosomatics that suggest explicitly or implicitly that psychoanalysis gives us the tools to identify etiology. This is a major point you make, and we'll return to it, but can you say something about this implicit or explicit notion we carry that psychoanalysis gives us the tools to identify etiology?
So, you know, in the papers, I kind of go diving into some really old work, old for us today, but that was published in the days when psychoanalysis was really popular and psychoanalytic research and papers such as Franz Alexander's work were published in major medical journals and popularized and also published in Psychoanalytic Quarterly while also being published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. And the work I'm referring to there is a work that was based on some research done at the Psychoanalytic Institute in Chicago, which came up with a specificity theory, the idea there being that there are certain psychosomatic diseases, paradigmatic ones, including colitis and peptic ulcer, and that there were specific conflicts that were associated with each of those specific diseases, such as issues with rage associated with asthma. That's a really kind of, if one reads that, that would be a more obvious example of how if a patient is coming and saying, oh, I have asthma, or a patient is coming and saying, finally, I'm ready to start trying to have a baby. I worked out all of this stuff and finally here I am. And now I can't. It's not working. If we come in there with, as you introduced, our knowledge that, well, I guess that means we haven't
fully analyzed. Those were air quotes around the knowledge.
Yes, sorry. I know I'm not visible.
People can't see that, right? Yeah.
Yes. So the sense we have that we know, if we come in with a sense we have that we know that the reason the patient is not succeeding in getting pregnant must be and is rooted in insufficiently resolved work. We got to do more. We got to do more with the maternal introject, with the conflict with femininity, the various things that you hinted at in your introduction. If we come in that way, then the way we're meeting the patient is colluding with her own fantasy. In other words, what I'm trying to write about in these papers is that the patient comes in trying to make sense. Wait, why can't I get pregnant? What's happening? And I have some examples in the papers about patients of mine who said, well, I always knew I wasn't really a woman. I have, you know, a really flat chest, and I grew up, but I never really fully became a woman because of this and that with me and my mother. I say this and that, but of course, these are extremely deep and complex and meaningful experiences and psychic realities that are worked on for years in the case of the patient I'm talking about in a 16-year analysis. But they kind of come to a pitch in the moment of there being infertility or severe nausea and vomiting for, like, to the point of real disturbance in the first trimester that the patient interprets as really in connection with when I was little and I caused, and again, I would use air quotes, but in fantasy, I caused the destruction of my little sibling. I now got pregnant, but you see, I'm extremely suffering from extreme nausea and vomiting because really internally, I am bad. I am toxic. I am destructive, just as I always was. And that's why I'm having this kind of bad experience of pregnancy. So the patient is making sense of her experience, just like we all make sense of all of our experiences, in line with her internal world, in line with her sense of self, in line with her sense of self-other as it's constructed inside. She is toxic. She is destructive. She is malevolent. She was then. She's quite guilty about that. She caused destruction. And here she is now again in her internal world. If I come in to meet the patient in that moment with my belief that in fact, a toxic internal worlds and all kinds of psychic realities are causative, do create extreme nausea and vomiting in pregnancy, or in another patient's case, the inability to become pregnant, then, you know, we can all sense how different a psychoanalytic atmosphere that would be from what we normally strive for, which is a very open, non-judgmental, neutral in the most benevolent sense, opportunity to open. And if we were to be neutral in a benevolent sense and quite open to what the patient's experience is and understood that as fantasy, then we get in there to analyze what internal world stuff is happening that is causing so much suffering. But we miss doing that if the way we hear what the patient is saying is, aha, she discovered it. In fact, that is why infertility happens or pregnancy malaise.
Would it be fair to characterize this as an issue of content versus function? That is, if we join and celebrate the discovery of the truth that we read in a paper last night about these causes, that's the content. But you're suggesting that we keep our eye attuned to what function is this serving for the patient to be so certain about something she cannot be certain about?
Yes. That's one part of it. And then, Harvey, how do we do that if how we hear the patient is, yep, aha, A plus, you got it. I too know
Right. Same time, baby and bathwater thing, we don't want to ignore emotional contributions to physical difficulties. It is not unusual, for example, where patients will be struggling with transference-related affects of an intense awkward and upsetting sort. And in the face of that, we'll develop any one of various medical, somatic type of conditions. And when the obstacle to the verbal expression and experience of what those transference affects are is brought to their attention in a meaningful way, they experience it in words, the somatic symptoms fall away. That's not unusual. And we don't want to ignore, we don't want the listener to suggest that we don't understand that that too is part of what our work is. Anything to say about that?
Yes. Thank you so much for bringing that up. Of course, I wouldn't be in our field if I didn't, you know, join you and everybody else in understanding that. But, you know, there's this moment I love in a Winnicott paper, where he talks about psychosomatic, the paper is called Psychosomatic Illness in its Positive and Negative Aspects. And there's a little moment in there where he writes about somatization and somatic things versus what he calls psychosomatic. And what he's trying to differentiate there, I think, really speaks to what you are bringing up. What he's trying to differentiate is all the things you're mentioning, which we all have, but some more and some less, depending on how we're organized and how much access we have to the capacity to reflect, to capacity to move from affect to thought, or from an affect storm to reflection. So the more capacity we have to do that, the more we are able to use the palpitations, the physical rev up to move, why am I feeling this, and to move towards something. But that, so that is the body entering the room, and sometimes it's kind of all body all the time, and there isn't enough of the other stuff, and that's what we develop in the course of the treatment. But what Winnicott differentiates that from is psychosomatic per se, which is not the same as anytime there's something somatic. Psychosomatic involves, as per that wonderful paper, I use that paper a lot when I'm teaching. What he writes in there is that not every time the body is going on here, we are in the realm of psychosomatic. We are in the realm of psychosomatic when there's a particular kind of relationship of the psyche-soma, one where there's a dissociation, where there's a split, where there's some kind of defense. And we can bring that up to date because that paper was not written in 2025. So we can bring that up to date and say, you know, we know more now about all kinds of physical things. And so we know more now that some things that maybe we used to think were caused by something today we know are not, or today we know that we don't know. But I think the idea there that I really find very useful in this Winnicott paper is to differentiate between when the body is there, and then we are working in the way that you described and that everyone listening works, versus when there's something that is a kind of conundrum presented by the body. I really think of it as the body makes a demand upon the mind for work. Obviously, I didn't come up with that. Freud came up with that in talking about instinct. And but when there's a kind of disturbance to the self presented by the body, and then there's a grappling there, and there's something very potent that happens if we understand that grappling and meet it in a closed or in an open way. And I think we need to really carefully differentiate when are we talking about somatic and the body, as you brought up, and when are we in the realm that we in our literature call psychosomatic? And I think we do so, if I may touch a sacred cow here a little bit, I think we do so in a rather over-inclusive way that needs to be re-examined, what that means, psychosomatic.
Beautifully said. Thank you. Let's talk about some cases. Introduce, if you will, Mr. X, the work with whom demonstrates much of what you've said.
So Mr. X was a man in his 50s whom I saw for a brief consultation of several meetings. at a cancer hospital that I did a postdoctoral fellowship in some 25 years ago or so. He was there. He was in the hospital for a recurrence of testicular cancer, which is a very rare thing. Testicular cancer is common when it happens to happen in one's 20s, and the cure rate is extremely high. I don't have my numbers right now, but I'll say 95% or above. So the fact that he's now in for a recurrence, was then in for recurrence 30 some odd years later, was quite unusual. And the that was being explored by the medical team. He was in the hospital for that. And I was called in to consult because he was having trouble sleeping and he was reserved and anxious and aloof. And I was called in. I come in to meet with him in a hospital room. He's wearing a flimsy little gown and a bathrobe and reading the Wall Street Journal. And there was this combination of a very kind of very aloof and guarded person. But as soon as we started speaking, what came out is that he was speaking with a kind of smile on his face that was quite striking, almost like, a very eerie smile. And I inquired about that because he was talking about having trouble sleeping and having ruminative thoughts at night. And so I pointed out that he's telling me this while smiling in a certain way. And what immediately came out is that he said that actually having this recurrence of the cancer is a punishment perfectly fitting with the crime. And that he had been waiting for this for the past 30 some odd years, waiting for the other shoe to drop, because to begin with, he believes that he had his first cancer, his first testicular cancer, as a result of the fact that he's a compulsive masturbator and had been so from his teenage years, masturbating many, many times a day. Back in his 20s, he had his first surgery and he had a marriage and that marriage broke apart. But since then, the compulsive masturbation involves a use of pornography and pornography of a certain kind. And this is a deeply Catholic married person, a suburban dad married person, Catholic. So what came out is this very intact view and belief on his part, which I refer to in the paper as his psychosomatic theory, which is really a fantasy construction, mm-hmm. that the reason that he has the cancer, had it and has it now again, is that he's being punished. Essentially, the first time he was being punished with a semi-castration, and now we're here to finish the job because of his sin of this repeated masturbation in secret, hiding from his wife. And of course, we can hear in all of that so much guilt, and there are many, many layers to the guilt having to do with his background and his upbringing and his religion and his, I believe and came to understand then, also just a kind of core conflict with having sexual pleasure of any kind. So that was his take on what was happening. And what I point out in the paper is that there's something extremely seductive in there for us, because he unconsciously believed that he had kind of essentially brought upon his own castration, because that's a punishment perfectly fitting with the crime. He was overly sexual. He was sexual at all. He got too much of that going on. That's wrong. And this is the punishment. So there's a kind of concretization where the guilt, the unconscious death wish, the unconscious need for punishment is converted. This is all psychic reality, right? Is converted into a bodily fact, which is the cancer. That was his sense of what was happening. And that's weirdly coherent with some of our earlier theories that all kinds of psychic conflict does get converted and becomes inscribed in the body in the form of somatic reality.
If we listen to the certainty of his psychological theory and see that as the symptom, the need to make up something and with conviction. It seems to match up with the other open question, which is what led to the compulsive masturbation? That too is a symptom. That isn't driven by a search for sexual pleasure. That's a something. We don't know what.
Right.
But it's as if there are two certainties going on. I have to do this, and I have to conclude the meaning of this is that. And to your point, if we accept, that's the meaning, then we've closed off the whole space where we can discover how terrified he may be about this cancer. And whatever vulnerabilities underlie this compulsive symptom.
Yes, the vulnerabilities, right. There's such a complex relationship that he and all of us have with our bodily selves. And that relationship is, as I was hinting at, starting to say before, is made up of so much that has been internalized from our earliest intersubjective lives, where, as again Winnicott said, that's where the indwelling of the psyche and the soma gets set up. That's where we have a chance to develop as embodied beings, where there's some decent level of unity between psyche soma, where we come to kind of reside in our bodies and be vital and embodied and alive. Something went awry for him early on that led to that, as you say, to that symptom. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of vulnerability already there. There's so much to understand in the relationship between this person and his body. And inscribed in that relationship is all kinds of, a masochistic submission. I am bad. I need to be punished. Right there between him and his body, there's some malevolent, punitive, scrutinizing gaze that says you're bad. And that's what we need to be working to open and understand. And that's with regard to his experience now. And as you point out, of course, with regard to the compulsive masturbation and what got set up in his sexuality in the first place.
One can't discuss psychosomatics and the history of it without discussing Joyce McDougall. And you do consider her work in your paper. And let me ask you to read a section, just an excerpt, where you question some of her assumptions.
So this is in relation to a paper of hers about a woman in her, I believe, 40, who had breast cancer. So the section is, McDougall's patient presents vivid fantasies of her cancer's origins and its links to her mother. The patient wrote what McDougall characterizes as a reconstruction of her infancy, in which she said, the patient, "And so the fear became a black mass invading every pore of the little baby, the black mass that is invading every centimeter of the baby's body, and slowly it becomes a crab, a cancer, except that the baby has no name for it." This powerful image and others like it clearly indicate the patient's fantasies about the origin of her cancer and reveal the kind of idiosyncratic meaning saturated with fantasy which patients attribute to their disease. They raise the vexing clinical question about the meaning of the analyst's acceptance of such fantasies as reconstructions or discoveries of a truth, as opposed to her exploration or analysis of the function of such multi-layered fantasies for the patient.
And that's such a central point, to understand the function of these fantasies as opposed to accept the manifest content as containing latent meanings. And it's a real error in our past, yeah? Among others, that's one of the real errors we need to address. And as you point out, it affects the nature of the work. And as you also point out, and I'm going to ask you to describe a patient of yours, it can have an influence on the medical care they seek. Yes. Which is a whole other level of consequences. Introduce, if you will, Mr. Y to us.
So Mr. Y was a young guy, 26 years old, when he came to see me. And this is a person I saw for a few years in my private practice, already past the work in the hospital. He had Hodgkin's disease, which is supposed to be, as you know, the quote unquote good kind of lymphoma to have, because it's much more treatable. Mm-hmm. And in fact, one of the things that he came in with saying is how enraged he was about having been, that's not proving to be the case with him. He had had multiple treatments, very grueling treatments, by the time he came to see me. And none of them eradicated his disease, and nothing achieved what was, what would technically be called remission. So he came, and the definition of where he was at physically was that his disease had stalled. So this was a really creative young guy, full of life. He was a sculptor. He worked in the arts. He had an older brother who was also in the arts in a different field. And his treatment at the outset involved his directly linking his childhood and his relationship with his parents to his disease. And what he said about it, he described his life growing up, he described his relationships with his parents as toxic, and their love for him as giving him the sense that he was off, he wasn't right, he wasn't as lovable as his brother, harder to love than his brother. And he had this conviction that he had internalized all of this toxic love. Toxic was his word, poison, also his word, and that that over time gradually led to his developing illness. And he was quite angry with his parents. This was very complicated in the transference, of course, because he was quite angry at his doctors. He was quite angry sometimes at me. And we did a lot of work around that, and kind of the guiding, his primary fantasy for a long time was that he's ill because of this. So this led to many things, kind of a sense of revenge, anger at his parents, almost a fantasy of, at some point, a kind of almost manic fantasy of control, as though I'm showing them, now they see what pain is, I'm getting back at them, because they were quite pained, of course, by his experience, by his illness. There was a lot of work done around that. And the work kind of led with successive cycles to a more modulated, mixed, we can call it depressive position kind of experience, where he would, you know, come to love and hate, and come to be angry and understanding of them, of people who were trying to help him, of himself. And then there was a worsening of the disease. And his reaction to that was to get very intensely involved with an alternative healer who was into raw foods and injections of substances, including urine and various other things. And the patient became very attached to this healer. And the threat then in the treatment, I mean, one very obvious one was, is he going to leave his cancer hospital and doctors and replace them with this, which is something that he kept threatening. And so a lot of the work then, in terms of, again, trying to come back to something more nuanced, something more mixed, was to allow for him to explore all of this and continue to receive medical care. And the fantasy reigning then was really fascinatingly that he would, through this alternative way of treating his body, as dictated by this guru, really cleanse himself, cleanse the inside of his body. And what's so fascinating there, really, for our way of thinking as analysts, is he really quite concretely viewed that as almost the way we talk about the internal world, that in cleansing his body, he would be cleansing the toxic sense of himself and way of being loved that he had taken in from his parents. So it was kind of this, you know, flattening sense that he would be cleansing his actual body and his also his psychic internal world and sense of self. And there would there thus be some kind of rebirth. This was not a psychotic person at all. I just really want to say, really smart, thoughtful, young guy. But this was a
very frightened,
very frightened. And this gave him a sense of potential mastery. And there was a kind of manic tinge to it because he was going to be, there was going to be an auto rebirth and he would be cleansed and he would beat the entire, as he put it, paradigm of cancer.
You write about it very beautifully. Let me read how you describe your encounter with him over this. You write, "I was often explicitly called upon to affirm Mr. Y's theory of the origin of his disease. At times he challenged me, 'You don't believe me, do you?' This was, of course, a loaded question because beyond its content, the very taunt or challenge of it paralleled his aggressive opposition to his mother, which was designed to mask and ward off threatening neediness, vulnerability, and wishes for a rescuing union. I interpreted this question as Mr. Y's own projected doubt and lurking feelings of not knowing what to believe. And I spoke to him about his need to feel that he knows for sure, as that mitigates the feeling of being hit by lightning." You go on to say, "At times I focused on the dilemma of whether to know something that is so painful to contend with exacts a more or less bearable price than to consider truly not knowing. The cost of believing there was a known psychological cause included guilt and self-recrimination about not undoing or combating it. I said, 'And what if there is no way to know ultimately? How to live with that?' This work, which we cycled back into and through time and again, reestablished the collaborative quality of sessions and led to a softening of Mr. Y's anger. It placed us together in the position of being on the brink of not knowing." Now, it may be regressive on my part to be drawn to a favorite sentence in a paper, but I will embrace that because this sentence, "It placed us together in the position of being on the brink of not knowing," I think is really A, beautifully said, and also very important, because to tolerate the not knowing, which was sounds to me what he was most allergic to, was only possible when he was having an experience of together. And I think your work with him describes that in a quite special way. This brings us to the whole notion of analysis and illness. And Mort Reiser, an analyst from years ago who I had the pleasure of meeting a number of times, he also was focused on psychosomatics, and he wrote the following, and you quote him in one of the papers, that the symbolic representation of disease is replete with the material of psychosomatic, in the material of psychosomatic patients, but that the question of whether they proceed and lead to disease through conversion mechanisms, or whether they are psychic elaborations after the fact, cannot be resolved by retrospective study of patients who already have the dysfunction. Acceptance of this principle, that the role of psychogenesis in somatic disturbance cannot be elucidated through the psychoanalytic method and process alone, leads to a different analytic atmosphere in the work with patients, as well as to a different kind of theorizing. If we let go of the aim of discovering etiology via the psychoanalytic process in the work with a patient with somatic dysfunction, then we are freed up to fully engage with the patient's own theory of psychogenesis and to analyze its multiple determinants. The clinical focus shifts much more consistently to the patient's experience, to his or her interpretation of what is going on in light of fantasies about the self and the object relational world that are expressed in the patient's relationship to his or her bodily self, for example, as an obstacle or punisher. The usefulness of the clinical process should not be measured in terms of its ability to identify the cause of and cure somatic dysfunction." That changes the goalposts, the goalposts which we in the past, and I dare say in the present in some form, also have in our minds, is that, well, if we really get to the core of the patient's difficulties, then their need to express that somatically will be altered to their medical benefit. I don't think I'm the only one that entertains that that I'm hesitating about magical thought. Oh, magical thought, hopeful thought, optimistic thought. What do you think?
So what you read there was from my other paper, which is a little bit earlier. And I say that, which was written a little bit earlier. And I say that to say that I wrote that when I was really trying to grapple almost in a shuttle diplomacy kind of way between, you know, I had finished my analytic training in 2008. And during the training and before, I had worked in all of these medical settings and with people that had body stuff. And I went to a psychoanalytic, I trained in psychoanalysis at an old school, wonderful old school institute. And it was really kind of staggering. I found difficult to grapple with in the medical bodily arena, the generally speaking absence of the internal world of patients, no space or curiosity about that. And that's fine. That is maybe how it needs to be, but that was quite powerful. And on the other hand, in the psychoanalytic arena, I felt that there was actually, even though we all grew up knowing that the ego is first and foremost a body ego, because we learned that from Freud, actually very little space made for the actual real body and its limits and the limits that it presents to us in its physicality. So it was the paper that you just quoted from, which was the first of these two, was kind of a beginning attempt at some kind of shuttle diplomacy between those two areas, and to kind of bring the real body and its limits and the physical world and grappling with our lack of power over it, lack of ultimate power over it, to more of the psychoanalytic side of things, and to bring a real openness to the internal world and fantasy and the way people experience their bodies, their illnesses, to the, you know, more medical bodily part of the world, and to kind of bring them back, bring them together. The point not being that there isn't a link, of course. And so you say, Harvey, magical thought, and I think sometimes it is a magical thought, and we can find that in our literature, and we can find it in ourselves, that if we analyze well enough, fully enough, then our patient will not die or will be healed from this or that. Now, I am not sitting here saying everyone else should embrace uncertainty and not knowing. And only I know. I obviously am very much part of us who do not really know, meaning we don't really know a lot. We know more than we did when a lot of our theory was written. And we need to account for that. We know more about some origins of some physical disease. We know more about the complexity of the interaction of things than we did then. So we need to go back and say, you know, what in the way I used to think I need to update now? But yes, we certainly know and hope for and work towards alleviating suffering, alleviating distress. And so patients may have flare-ups. Patients have, as I write about in this patient, Mr. Y, times when his experience of feeling more in control, more empowered, I think very much contributed to the reduction in his physical pain. So I'm not here to say that the work we do does not impact the way people inhabit their bodies and all kinds of other, sometimes quite mysterious, you know, hormonal processes and inflammatory processes that I am not prepared to characterize. But I am here to say that in the work that we do as psychoanalysts, we are not working at that realm. We are working at a different realm. And we have so much to offer in that realm, where so much of patient suffering is rooted. And So what that riser quote talks about and what I was trying to say and what you read is not that there are no mind-body links. Of course there are. And also not that in the work we do, we never affect them, but rather that there are times when the atmosphere of the work we do is really compromised, I think, by some of the ways we used to see things and sometimes still see things. And that that leads us to collude with very deep and important fantasies that patients have about themselves, as opposed to do what we normally seek to do, which is to unpack such fantasies, to open them and understand them as fantasies with all of the many consequences of that.
I'm picturing you going, like you say, shuttle diplomacy of going back and forth from the medical hospital to the analytic center and being in different worlds, different languages, different experiences of what it means to be a patient, different kinds of patients. And let me read your closing comment from that paper because it really captures it. You write, "The different newer stance, the one that you just outlined, would be characterized by complex analysis of patients' psychosomatic theories, fuller focus on the patient's experience, and a freedom for investigation that would derive from and further enable consistent acknowledgement of uncertainty and recognition of the limits, and on the other hand, the particular possibilities of our method." Sharon, I hear you trying to help us, the field, and patients ultimately, maintain that analytic space that we are devoted to maintaining, because it can be such a powerful space for patients to grow and discover themselves. And whether it be from the patient side or our theory side, you are resisting these very human inclinations to turn away from ambiguity and helplessness and uncertainty, and saying it's okay to tolerate it. It's in all of our best interest, even as it is terribly uncomfortable for all concerned. Do you think that's a fair sense of your journey?
I think that's a very generous way of putting it, because I don't claim to have mastered the art that I don't believe any of us ever masters.
Of course not.
But that is the... that I think that is the purpose, is to aim for, you know, Joyce McDougall, with whom I kind of go to battle in these papers, gave us so many wonderful ideas, including Plea for a Measure of Abnormality. I really think that the purpose is to really make space for the unknown, uncertainty, and for our kind of humility in the face of the complexity of our belonging to the physical world. So it's our animality, our physicality, all of that is so complicated and difficult to grapple with. And the unknown is, and uncontrollable, is a huge abyss, as we know, for everybody. So...
sure.
I do think that I'm trying to pivot here a little bit towards meeting the patient's attempts to grapple with that unknown and working to understand the patient's attempt to make sense in line with their internal world, which is, you know, composed of a whole history and lots of meaning and lots of pain and lots of desire and good and painful things, to really make kind of a radically open space to that, for the patient's attempt to grapple with the unknown in line with their internal world and therefore how they relate to their bodily experience and how they make sense of it. And to really work very hard to recognize that we really like to rush in and say, well, the mind can conquer the body, and it's really the mind first, and it's the psychic reality that creates the bodily reality, and therefore I can help because I know what to do with psychic reality. So I can help with the psychic reality, and then I can help with the bodily stuff, which certainly we all hope and try to do and sometimes can. But sometimes we can't, or we don't know. We really don't know. And I think in many places in our literature, we are very busy trying to defend against that or push against that or defy that with a kind of explanatory thinking about how the body comes to have and be in whatever reality it is, as though we have the ability to know it with our tools and our work.
And you close with, as I read, an emphasis on honoring, as you call it, the particular possibilities of our method.
Yes.
And that's the challenge you've laid out for yourself, for us all, to explore the particular possibilities of our method.
Yes.
Sharon, thank you. It's been a great pleasure and journey reading and studying these papers and talking with you about them, because it highlights some detours that we make to tolerating these uncertainties, which we is tempting, obviously, for all of us. And it brings us back to our task and our abilities. And I'm grateful for that. Thank you.
Thank you, Harvey.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.